Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and Bruce Kimmel is with us. Hi, Bruce.
Hello, people, and Donald.
Bruce is back. You haven't been here in a little more than a year. I wanted to get you back here right after Sondheim had passed away.
Yeah, but I didn't like you then.
But you didn't like me then. Even though your website hosts the radio show.
But I got over it.
You got over it. It didn't work out.
Yeah, was it still the pandemic when I was
here? I think it was, but it was sort of like when things had calmed down.
Because
it was, or actually, I think we may have done it by Zoom. We may have actually done a Zoom one.
Really?
We might have, because I think I did a Zoom one with you. Huh. Anyway, but you have a lot of things for us to catch up on.
Yes.
Because you've been very busy.
God.
We will talk a little bit about Stephen Sondheim, because you had kind of a long association.
I would not call it a relationship. We would call it a relationship. I was never invited to certain rooms.
But, but you did know him. He was an acquaintance.
I did.
He'd recorded quite a few Sondheim
stuff. I know him. I was at his house.
You had a lot of correspondence.
I shared a cab with him. Lot of correspondence.
So we'll talk about that in a minute. But first, I'm going to talk about Sammy, S-A-M-I,
yes, the series. Sammy with an I.
Which just had its premiere last week on Amazon.
Two days ago.
But when this airs, it will have been a week.
Oh.
Yeah, because it's going to air on a Sunday.
This is not live?
This is not live. You know that, Bruce. Anyway, Sammy premiere. I watched all 10 episodes. So for people, we want to encourage people to go to Amazon.
We do. Watch. Amazon Prime Video, search Sammy, and it comes up first now.
Yes. And I will provide a link on the radio page
so people
can get directly to it on Amazon.
Yeah.
It is a purchase, but that's a requirement on Amazon.
It is. That used to not be the case.
Right. It's very inexpensive, though.
Because when Kevin Spiritus put up his web series, he could do it for free.
Right.
And that's what we thought we could do, but no. But we chose the cheapest.
Right. It's like
$7.99.
It's 99 cents an episode, but it's a bargain if you pay $7.99, you get all 10 episodes.
Yeah.
Which is what I paid. And it was great. It's a lot of fun. Not what I expected.
Oh, really?
No. I mean, I kind of figured. I mean, I think because I hadn't read too much. I mean, I read your daily notes on your Haynes's Way website. And I didn't want to read too much about the show because I kind of like to be surprised when I see it. But it is a real throwback to like the 1970s sitcoms that I know you had made. You were involved in quite a few of those, like Happy Days.
As an actor, yeah.
Partridge Family. And I think you were – did you do a Brady Bunch episode?
Never.
No, but you did Partridge Family recurring.
Yes.
But describe the show because it's also the show it kind of reminded me the most of in some ways was That Girl.
Yes, that was the role for me. Mm-hmm. Even though I don't know that I've ever actually seen a full episode of That Girl, but I know what it was.
Right.
And that was the role model about a struggling actress
who moves to
New York. I mean, I created this for Sammy Stateman, who plays Sammy Sherman in the show.
Right.
And when I told her we were going to call it Sammy, she was very nervous about that because she thought people would think it was about her.
Right.
And I said, no, this character is nice. Mm-hmm. So she laughed and understood me perfectly. But it's so that was kind of in my head instantly. Mm-hmm. Because other people were pitching me other kinds of things that were negative, and I just wanted something that's not like today's sitcoms, because I really cannot stand put down humor, you know, for 30 minutes.
Right.
And that's all as I flip through, I don't watch anything really, but as I flip through stuff, that's all I, you know, is, you know, over the top.
Right.
Too loud.
A little edgy.
Yeah, a little edgy. And I wanted something that was lovable. And I said that to Sam. I said, I want people to fall in love with your character and all the characters. And even when there's somebody who's maybe a little mean behind the audition table, I wanted that to be funny, but not yucky.
Right. Right.
And I think we achieved it, and that was my goal anyway. And yes, it's a total throwback to those shows, but with one difference, of course.
Right. And even though it's lighthearted and warm and fun, it's also a relatively realistic look at being a struggling actor in New York.
I think so.
With the constant auditions, working catering jobs, doing temp jobs, doing, you know, recording demo tracks.
I have enough kids that I've worked with who are now old or older,
right.
Not as old as I am, who are in there. And I hear the stories every day, especially from Sammy, who's was struggling a lot, which is why I thought this is really perfect.
Right. And the 10 episodes actually do have an arc.
There's no through line, but there is
a progression.
That's exactly right.
With the episodes. Because I mean, it's not like you can't pretend what happened in the last ones didn't happen, because there are some running jokes, which we won't go into. There's the YouTube joke, which we will not talk about, because that's a surprise. But that kind of follows through the several episodes.
Yeah.
So there is sort of through running gags, but it's a very episodic kind of thing. And talk about the rest of the casting, because it's so well cast, not only with all the amazing cameos, because there's like people, I also did not look ahead of time to see who was in each episode.
Oh, good.
So people kept popping into episodes and I go, Isn't that Brad Oscar? And then Karen Ziemba shows up, and I'm not going to give too much away, but there's a lot of New York people who pop up.
Yeah, I just went to all my friends.
You filmed in New York?
We filmed 8 in New York in 10 days.
Oh, my God.
That was a schedule, but we never went over, and we never ran late.
Right. And let's tell everybody, these are not like traditional 30-minute
episodes. No, these are between 10 and 18.
Right. So they're quick and easy to watch.
But I will tell you, they are chock. Even when we were editing it, I'm going, this is 10 minutes, because there's so much plot or stuff in each episode that you never feel like it's overstaying its welcome, which was important to me.
No, but there is a lot in each episode.
Yeah, there is a lot of stuff.
Getting back to casting, tell us who is playing Sammy's mom.
Yeah, it's Carrie O'Malley, who I've worked with for years. She's done a lot of Kritzerland shows and readings for me.
Right. And Broadway credits.
And a lot of Broadway. She did the Into the Woods revival in 2001, I think it was.
Right, the Vanessa Williams one.
Yes, and she did the encores Promises, and she was in Billy Elliot on Broadway. And she's wonderful. She does a lot of TV now, a lot of TV and film. But well,
what I like about Carrie is that she's so instantly relatable, and you instantly see her as a mom.
Yeah.
But you see her as a mom who has something going on.
Sense of humor.
Right. And she's funny and she's smart.
And likable.
Right.
That was the key. Likeable. And I wrote it for her. I mean, there was nobody else I was going to cast. I would have had to if she'd said no, but there was no saying no to me. And she actually looks like Sammy in a way. She has a similar mouth and a similar nose.
Yep.
So that was fun. Mm-hmm. That was a bonus. And then Kareem Hazim, who plays Sammy's friend, went to school with her.
Oh, okay.
And I was very, very not wanting to go to there. I just felt, well, that's cheating maybe a little, is he good? Or what? You know, I didn't know anything about him. And she was, I think she thought that might be weird too. But I must have seen 20 or 30 submissions. You know, they send video now. And there were some really good people, but Kareem did it, and I don't think he had Sammy with him when he did or maybe he did, I don't remember, but it was just instant because he was so real and not over the top. And all the tapes I was getting were really emphasizing the gay thing, you know, which I didn't want to do. I didn't want stereotypes.
Right.
And he's just so, even my editor was so taken with him because he's so relatable.
Well, he's very real.
And he's real and
he comes across
funny.
As real and not real actory.
No.
Which is good, because it's a little bit of a really good balance with all the kind of wackiness that's going on around them.
Yeah.
That he's sort of like this stabilizing force in her life, because he's her best friend who lives two doors down the hall.
Yes.
In the same apartment building. And so he's always sort of like that balancing force in the show.
Yeah, he's easy to work with. And I mean, mm-hmm. my biggest direction was speak up.
Right.
Because I think they teach these kids today.
He's very soft-spoken.
To be soft.
Right.
I just speak up.
Right. So, and then let's talk about Grandma.
Grandma, of course, I wrote for my friend Cindy Williams, who I've known for 58 years, and sadly she passed away literally 8 weeks after we wrapped.
Right.
Shocker.
Did you write it? You wrote it specifically for
Cindy. I wrote it for her.
And did she know you were writing this
She
for her?
Did. I okay. told her. Originally, I'll give you the real history of this. I was going to do this kind of series, but a whole different plot mm-hmm. for Peyton Kirchner, this young kid was working with. Right. We were going to call it Peyton's Place. Mm-hmm. And Cindy was going to play her grandmother and had said yes. And then when I told her this was going to be this new thing, mm-hmm. she said, I said yes. I said yes. And you're saying yes now because you have no choice. Mm-hmm. You're saying yes. And I sent her all the scripts, and she had agreed in advance, but mm-hmm. I said, it really won't take you long. We're shooting 2 days in LA, mm-hmm. three days in LA, and all your phone conversations can be done at one time in one location.
Right.
She goes, really? That won't take a week? I said, it'll take an hour, Cindy. Mm-hmm.
Right. change of wardrobe.
Yeah,
and then, exactly. And video, and that's it.
So I sent her the scripts and she calls me immediately. She goes, I can't play this woman. I said, why? She goes, because they're Jewish. I said, what? Where are they? I said, he's Jewish.
Right. It doesn't come up that much.
Here's all you have to play. I said, just imagine that you and I at 17 at Los Angeles City College had gotten married. Mm-hmm. She goes, oh, okay. And she was right, you know, and you know, she asked if she could futz with lines. And I said, of course you can. And sometimes they were better and sometimes they weren't. And, mm-hmm. you know, she's very good about that stuff, mm-hmm. as was everybody.
Well, and I mean, to remind people of your long association relationship with Cindy, because you not only knew each other as teenagers at LACC.
Yeah, we were 17.
You worked together many times.
A lot of time. Well, I mean, I did three episodes, mm-hmm. and we did 4 Donnie and Marie shows, and she's in both movies I directed.
Right.
So yeah, it's a long involved.
Right. And it's so nice to see her in what turned out to be her final project. That
yeah, because she's funny and she's warm. And she does.
And Cindy's always been that way.
Yeah.
I mean, she's always been obviously my first exposure to Cindy was American Graffiti. And she's always been kind of like that everyday normal girl. She was never like the beauty pageant type winner.
Yeah.
She was always the funny, approachable, normal girl who you could relate to.
Yeah.
Because she's so open.
She's really funny and
she's so good in this.
So naturally to her.
Right.
And you know, she's on the FaceTime calls for most of the
until the last two episodes.
But the final two are shot here when Sammy comes home to visit her home.
And she is so good in those scenes with all the other actors.
Yeah.
Which is what kind of really struck me is because it's always a struggle to do those FaceTime acting.
Well,
things.
Especially when you're not acting with her.
Right.
Because they were shot at totally different times.
Right. So it's really difficult to do those. But then when you see her on set with the rest of the cast, she's just so in the moment.
Oh,
she's
yeah.
She's so in the scenes. And she just, and you literally believe that she's the grandma.
Yeah.
You literally believe they're all related because she just exudes that kind of aura.
And her relationship with her husband is amusing.
It is. It's some you don't see her husband because no, he's some cantankerous old man.
He's the Carlton the doorman.
Right. He's always out of camera range, but he's not out of vocal range. He's always making
he's
comments
in the bathroom.
In the background.
Or
Yes.
And I wrote the tennis match specifically because I wanted to give her something funny.
Some physical comedy. Yes. And she handles it with typical Cindy Williams.
She's 75 years old. And she's running around that tennis court.
Right. She was it was amazing to watch.
Yeah.
It was so fun.
And so that was a really grateful that we had this one last adventure together. Because I said to her the final day of shooting, which is the last time I talked to her, I said, you know, we're going to be doing this when we're 100. You know this, don't you? And she goes, yes, I do. And sadly.
But there's also, you've posted online lots of pictures from the shooting days.
Oh, yeah.
And there's some great shots of you and Cindy together. Yeah. I mean, some wonderful, delightful shots of the two of you together.
Well, we loved each other.
Yeah. So what is, the show obviously has been out for a few days when we're taping this.
Right.
But what's the response been so far?
Overwhelming, really.
Oh, good.
I mean, I haven't heard nothing negative about the show. And, I have friends who will not be kind if they don't
they will tell you what they really think.
Okay. Right. And I would expect nothing less,
right? Because you have to just to give people a heads up, don't go in expecting Seinfeld, or it's not that kind of show.
No, it's not.
It's a warm, funny, charming show with very relatable characters,
but I will say,
and they're nice people.
The one thing I'm proudest of, sort of, is it's really hard when you don't have a studio audience and you're not sweetening with a laugh track,
right,
to have people laugh out loud.
Of course.
And I'm getting lots of comments where they say, oh my God, I did a spit take when she did that. Or there is a spit take in the show.
Yes, there is.
It would be nothing without a spit take and a pie fight.
Right, exactly. And you got both in.
I got both in. Well, I've been threatening to bring the pie fight back for 30 years.
And you did.
And nobody has done one in that 30 years, I don't think. And I was determined, and it was the second episode, and I had so much fun. We had 50 pies.
And I believe you used every single
one of them.
Yes.
Well, we used 49 because one guy screwed up.
Oh, yes. I think I read about that. I think
blocked the shot.
Yes. And the other thing that surprised me about the show was how much music is in this.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I figured because she is a performer and she does musical theater stuff and she's auditioning for things in New York, I figured that we would get, you know, one song, maybe one number per episode, but you found very unique ways to get her to sing and insert songs into the show. And they're songs that fit.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they fit the character, they fit what's going on in the plot, they fit what's going on. And you either have her, sometimes you have her in a recording studio.
It's all real. It's all all the songs in every episode except 10 are real. She's either in the studio or she's on doing an open mic night or auditioning.
Right.
That's how
they're in an organic part.
That's right. The songs function that way. And there is one song per episode until episode 10, in which case there are, I think, six.
Yes. I was like, oh my God, episode 10 is basically a mini musical.
Yeah, because she fantasizes her life as a musical with her cast of friends.
Tricky question. I know you wrote all the songs.
Yes, I did.
Obviously. And they're wonderful. And I've forgotten some of them, like Simply and so, I mean, because did you write any specific? You wrote some specifically for the show.
Yeah. In the final episode.
Because some of them were ones I know I'd heard before.
Yeah. No, all of them are from the catalog.
Okay.
Except the first two episodes, her audition songs are new.
Okay. Yes.
The girl with the dragon.
Don't give those away. I figured those were they're on the edge of being parody songs.
Well, they are parody.
They're basically parody songs. I knew you had to.
But they'll do musicals of those two things.
Of course they will.
So, but in episode 10, the My Life is a Musical is an original to this show, and BFF is an original. I think those are the. No, and Cindy's song is original. Right. So there are five brand new songs, and the rest are from other eras, shall we say. All the way back to, I have to tell you, all the way back to my second musical that I ever wrote.
Which was?
Feast, it was called.
Oh, okay.
The I'm on a Diet Blues.
I was going to say, that's the Carrie song. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, congratulations.
Well, thank you.
So I'm assuming there's plans, hopefully, for more episodes.
We'd love that.
I mean, how did this whole project come about landing at Amazon?
we brought it to them, and they're very picky these days, mm-hmm. and it took a while.
They are very picky because they're – I mean, I think the problem with a lot of the streaming services is that they went gung-ho with gigantic budgets and – I mean, because I understand the concept of having to create content. You have to have a lot of content for these streaming services. Yeah. But as my friends and I will tell you, it's sort of like – there's so much new content all the time, you can't keep track of it. And you can never – we'll sit down to watch something and we can't even remember what streaming service it's on.
Yeah.
We're like, well, we heard about this show, but I don't know what channel it's on. and then because there's so many of them, they do like one season and then it disappears. Or they do a couple seasons and people get hooked and it becomes so expensive because they're spending millions and millions of dollars on these shows and it's not worth it, and they cancel them.
Yeah, I mean, the hope is that Amazon will come to us and say, mm-hmm. how much did this cost? And you want to do season two. Mm-hmm. I would love that. That would be the obvious, because this was not cheap to do. Mm-hmm. Everybody thinks that when you do these on your own, you're spending $1,000.
Oh, no, you can tell.
This is a very costly show.
Right.
Because there's music, there's the piano, there's orchestra for two, and... it was, and all the actors got, even though we didn't have to, on the SAG thing we were on, we didn't have to pay anybody because we were on the low tier, whatever the lowest of the tier is, but we did pay everybody a stipend. And all the crew, you know, very, you know, everybody, nobody works for free.
Right.
And, you know, I have a world-class editor, and I and so it was expensive. So we'd either have to crowdfund it, because the person who put up the money for the first season is not going to – it just costs so much that I don't think they would go for a second season. But I don't know that for a fact, but we'll find out. Mm-hmm. And but we want to do a second – I've already got ideas.
Ideas, okay.
Where to go with it. And and people, I just think if people love these characters, they'll want to see more of them. And it takes 2 hours and 8 minutes to binge the entire all 10 episodes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I binged. I watched all 10 in a row.
And it's fun to do that.
I will admit, after the first episode, I did skip the opening titles.
Yes, you can. And they were done very well.
They're very cute. They're very 1970s sitcom-y.
Yes, they
which are. Which is exactly what it should be. But after the first episode, I was like, oh, thank God there's a skip button, because I don't need to I want to get to the actual meat of the episode. Well, everybody, you can use the link on the website. Go to Amazon.
Please, and leave reviews if you feel like it on the IMDb and
again,
the
Amazon. Again, it's $7.99 for all 10 episodes, which is cheap. So go watch and write a review. Because that helps get more people to watch and hopefully gets Amazon to want to have more episodes, which would be a good thing. One of the main reasons I had wanted to get together with you was to talk about Stephen Sondheim.
Steve.
Yes.
We called him Steve. Took a while.
So tell me about what was your first, you know, your first time communicating
hearing from Stephen Sondheim.
Dealing with Mr. Sondheim.
I had a record label in the late 80s called Bay Cities. And we did a lot of American classical music releases.
Yes.
And then I thought, well, why don't we branch out and do other things, you know, because I'm bored of these. And so one day I just picked up the phone and called Capitol, who had issued, I think at that time, 3 cast albums, Funny Girl, Follies, and what was the other one? Music Man. Or I think those were the 3. So they weren't doing it. They were sitting on the stuff. So I called the licensing department and I said, would you be willing to license some of your cast albums, you know, for a 3-year release, a limited edition or whatever we called them in those days. And they said, sure. What do you want? And I said, well, I'd like a funny thing happened on the way to the forum. And I think the others were Golden Boy and Celebration. May have been one other beyond that. And they did, and they were so cheap. I can't even tell you how cheap they were. And so we put out, funny thing happened on the way to the forum, and I'm sitting in the office one day, and we get our mail, and there's a little square envelope from 256 East 49th Street, and I go, who's writing me from New York? And I open the envelope, and it says Stephen Sondheim in the top of the note card, and it's typed, and it says, to whom it may concern, I wrote the score for A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, and here's a check, and I'd like to buy a copy. So I wrote him right back, and I said, I'm the whom.
That it may concern.
Yes, and here's your check back. I know who you are. I know you wrote the score.
Because he probably was thinking, oh, it's just some record company, yeah, and they're not going to know who I am.
I said, we all know who you are, and what a treat to hear from you, and thank you so much, and we're thrilled to release it. And I sent him 10 copies of the CD. And he wrote me back and thanked me, because he's really good about that stuff.
Yes. He was a big letter writer.
Yeah. So he wrote me back and said, thank you for that stuff. And thank you for returning the check. And thank you for the extra CDs. It sounds great. And I wrote him back, now that the door was open.
Now the door was open, yes.
And I said, oh, no, you know what he said in that second letter was, I have a lot of your classical releases. I'm a big fan of American classical music, and I love the music of Robert Ward, and you've been doing a lot of Robert Ward. And I wrote him back, and I said, oh, that's so nice to hear. If you're missing anything, here's a catalog, and I'm happy to send you whatever you want. He wrote me back instantly and said, you're going to be sorry you ever said that. And he sent me a list of like 25 titles, which I sent him. He wrote me back, thank you. And then a little later, about 6 months later, and they were always, it started with Stephen Sondheim, yours sincerely or whatever. And then as we continued, by the third letter, it was Steve S. And then we got down to Steve. And he kept calling me Mr. Kimmel. I said, no, stop it. So we got to Bruce and Steve by the fourth letter, I'm sure. So about 6 months later, I was planning Classical Broadway, this album of classical music by Broadway composers. And I had already secured Harvey Schmidt and Charles Strauss and Cy Coleman and John Kander. So I wrote him and I said, I'm doing this album. And do you have any classical pieces you might have written when you were younger or any at any point? He wrote me back. He says, yes, I do. I have a violin sonata that I wrote when I was 15. And he said, and no one will ever be hearing it, including you. He said, but thank you for your interest. So that was funny. And then a week later, I got this idea. And I wrote him back and I said, you know, what would you think of this idea? What if we recorded the incidental scores for the two Arthur Lawrence plays you wrote music for, Invitation to a March and The Enclave? He said, now that's a good idea. That I would be thrilled with. So I said, but you know, that's only about 20 minutes of music, 22 minutes of music up between the two. What would you think? Do you have any songs laying around the house that haven't been recorded before? And he said, you know, I do. And he said, do you think people would be interested? I said, oh, oh, yes.
And what? When was this? What year
this was this? This was 91. And he said, that's lovely, and I'll send, I'll start sending you stuff. And he had Paul McKibbins, who ran his publishing company, sent me all this stuff that nobody, if they'd heard it, it's because he sent them a tape, you know. But none of this stuff had been recorded. Cut songs from Company and Forum and just everything you'd ever want to have. And we could never do it at Bay Cities. So time just kept going on. And at the end of 92, I said, you know, we're never going to be able to do it. I want to produce albums. I don't want to do reissues my whole life. And I'd already produced the Anastasia Affair and Classical Broadway and Classical Hollywood and David Shire album. And I was just chomping at the bit to be a real guy. Mm-hmm. And even though I didn't know anything about it. And so I said, let's close the company down. We're getting shafted by our distributor constantly. We never have any money. We're not getting paid. Mm-hmm. What is the point?
Right.
Let's, you know, divest ourselves. You know, most of this is licensed, so we don't own it anyway. Mm-hmm. And so we closed down the company, and because we had started to do soundtracks and we had started to poach or encroach on Verez Saraband's territory, and they were very upset because we were getting a lot of stuff they wanted.
Because they were really big in soundtracks.
I remember that. Yeah. Huge. They were the biggest.
Yeah.
And we got Misery, and we got a lot of big pictures. Not Misery in Life, but Misery, right. The movie, Stephen King movie, which is a huge loser for us. But we got it. And Chris Kushler, who ran Verez, had taken me to lunch one day, and he said, why don't you shut down your company? Mm-hmm. He said, I know you've loved it, and you've done a lot of, you know, we had done 100 and something releases in 3 years. Mm-hmm. He said, but why don't you come here where we'll treat you better and you'll get paid and you can do whatever you want. You can have your own division.
Right.
Within certain budget constraints. I said, all right. And I did that and never looked back. So in 1993, I showed up for my first day at the office. I said, here's what we're doing. I said, I'm not dipping my toe in the water. I said, we're coming out swinging. Mm-hmm. And in a year, I want us to be the biggest independent producer of show music.
Right.
He said, I said, no, I'm serious. I said, so here's what we're doing right now. We're doing 3 albums immediately, and they're the 3 I had planned for Bay Cities, which was what turned out to be Unsung Sondheim, Michelle Nicastro's first album, Tuneful, and what was the third one? Oh my God, Liz Callaway. Mm-hmm. All those had been planned for Bay Cities.
Right.
And so I went to New York and we did them. And he was very happy. I will say he was very happy. I got to go. He arranged a ticket for me to see Company at Lincoln Center, the big cast reunion.
Right, yeah.
Wonderful day. And I went directly from his house seat in that to a house seat in his house.
Yes.
Where his dog tried to hump my leg upon.
So was he involved at all when you did the Unsung Sondheim album?
I would say this was a week before we recorded. And in the cab, I was going to see The Goodbye Girl, and he was going to Lincoln Center for the evening performance of Company. And we had the funniest conversation in the car, and I said, so we can do all the songs we've chosen. I've sent you all the choices. Mm-hmm. He said, I don't care. Do anything you want. He said, they're going to embalm me anyway. And he was young at that point still.
Yeah.
He's younger than I am now. And so during the course of prepping the stuff, most of it was off the page, the way he wrote it. Mm-hmm. But there were a couple of things where I didn't love the layout or an ending or a thing. And this is, I just told the story. We did my little Sondheim tribute at Kritzerland Cabaret. And I'm sitting in Jim Stenborg, who he had approved as the musical director because Jim had done a lot of work for Steve. Mm-hmm. And we're sitting in Jim's apartment with, I guess it was Mike Rupert was there and I was there and going through multitudes of Amy's, and the orchestrator was there, Larry Moore. And so Michael left, and I just looked at Jim Stenborg and I said, what is that ending? I said, it's a 5-minute song. You go on this huge journey, multitudes of Amy's and this and that and Amy me and Amy you. And at the end, he says, I'm ready now, marry me now for one beat. And then there's a chord, a bump. And I said, I can't ask Mike Rupert to do that. That's just, I want an ending. And then Jim Stenborg looks at me and goes, what do you mean? I go, what do I mean? I mean, make an ending for me. Let him hold the note for 12 counts.
Right, I was going to say, yeah.
That's what's fair to the singer after a journey mm-hmm. like that. And the listener, you want a result, right. a resolution to any song. And a bump, which is all they do now, by the way, mm-hmm. on Broadway. Mm-hmm. That's the thing now, is to go, bump, bump. You know, mm-hmm. I don't get it. Where's the ride outs? Right. Ride outs to me are the key to a successful song. So he just kept looking at me, and he goes, and then I said, Larry, what, you make an ending? And he goes, I don't know. And they're so scared of, and Jim's hands, I said, wouldn't play anything. He had his hand, I said, move over. And I said, put the tune in the ending. Mm-hmm. So it goes, da 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 I got off the bench, and he still couldn't, he wouldn't do it. And I said, we're doing that. That's what we're doing, right? Notate it. You know, Larry, notate it. And Larry and he, in unison, looked at me and said, you tell him. So I had to call Steve and tell him what we were doing. And he said, you know, if you, that's how you think it should be done, do it.
Right.
He said, you have a passion for it, do it. Because mm-hmm. Steve's motto is always, whoever has the most passion wins.
Right.
And believe me, when he has passion, you don't win.
Right.
And the other song was Walter Willison's song, Love's a Bond, mm-hmm. because the A part of the song, which is the intro verse, was the same as the B in terms of feel mm-hmm. and tempo. And I thought, well, then there's no difference. Well, I don't get it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I asked him, can we slow the A section down mm-hmm. so it's really treated like a verse,
right.
like a rubato verse? He said, oh, of course. And we did that. And that was the only things we had to run by him, really.
Should we play Multitudes of Angels?
Oh, yeah, because it's a wonderful. Larry did a gorgeous orchestration, and Mike Rupert just killed that song. I mean, killed in a good way.
Right.
And, yeah, play it.
Multitudes of Amy's crowd the streets below. Avenues of Amy's, office fulls of Amy's, everywhere I go. Wonder what it means. Oh, I wonder what it means. I see them waiting for the lights, running for the bus, milling in the stores and hailing cabs and disappearing through revolving doors. Multitudes of Amy's everywhere I look. Sentences of Amy's, paragraphs of Amy's, filling every book. Wonder if it means I've gone to pieces. Every other word I speak is something she says. Walls hang with pictures of Amy's, galaxies of Amy's dot the night skies. Girls pass and look at me with Amy's eyes. I've seen an audience of Amy's, watch a cast of Amy's act in a play. Seems there are more of her every day. What can of Amy's standing up to cheer. Choruses of Amy's, symphonies of Amy's ringing in my ear. I know what it means. Hey, Amy, I know what it means. Oh, wow, I'm ready. takes is two. Amy, me. Amy, you. Amy. I know what it means. Oh, wow. I'm ready. I'm ready. I'll say it. Marry me. Now.
So
12 counts.
Yes.
Off on 13.
Well, it makes more sense. I mean, I could see the cutoff the way he had it written if it was going in a slot where there was like interrupting dialogue that interrupts the song or something.
But it wasn't. But it was going in the Being Alive slot. It was the first song in the Being Alive slot.
Right. So it needs to
you have to
it has to have a big finish.
Resolve.
Right. Exactly.
And give it the emotion of that decision on his part. That it deserves, you know, it's not a question of right or wrong. It just, it you hear it and it deserves that. And I think everybody uses our ending now.
Right.
I don't know if anybody's recorded. I think, did Mandy record?
Oh, I think he might have.
Yeah.
He might have recorded it. So you've done, obviously, the Unsung Sondheim album was very successful.
Very successful.
Because there's so many Sondheim fans out there that kind of album is just
they couldn't believe it. Yeah, it couldn't believe it. It was Nirvana for them.
Right.
Because there are like 10 songs that had never been heard before,
right.
including really early stuff like the Kukla, Fran, and Ollie song.
Mm-hmm.
And
but you also did some other Sondheim. I mean, you did Sondheim at the Movies.
Sondheim at the Movies, which was really fun to do.
So talk about that one.
That was, again, I had to, you know, I was calling him at this point. So I called him and I said, I want to do your movie and TV stuff. And he thought that was great. And that was easy to put together, except that I said, the deal is you have to give me at least two songs from Singing Out Loud.
Oh.
We had done one of them on Unsung Sondheim, Water Under the Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And so he sent me Dawn. And which I just fell in love with, I have to say. And it made no sense to me until he explained the way it would work in the film.
Mm-hmm.
But I love that song, and he sent me Sand.
Right.
And they were incredible to record. Everything else, like the Evening Primrose stuff, had been done before, but I like ours, and Gary Beach and Liz Calloway. And but at that point, the glamorous life from the movie of Little Night Music had only had the soundtrack recording.
Right.
So I wanted to do that, and I wanted to do – what else is on that album?
Oh.
Well, all the stuff from Stravinsky I loved. So we did Little Sweet from Sweets from Stravinsky.
And you've got all the Dick Tracy stuff.
And that we have more and – well, all of it.
Back in Business.
Yeah, no, it's all of it. It's all four songs.
What Can You Lose? You have just about everything.
Yeah.
Guy Haynes sings What Can You Lose?
Yes, he does.
He does.
Can't sing in that key anymore.
And, of course, Sooner or Later.
Yeah.
With the wonderful Jane Krakowski.
And boy, let me tell you, nobody does that song better than Jane Krakowski. Nobody ever will. I will not tell you what was going on in that session, but it was amazing. That session was so hilarious in so many ways, but I can't talk about it.
Okay. Well, I one thing I will say, because I remember being in the studio, I think it was Westlake. And it wasn't for that, because I didn't know you yet at that point, I don't think. But I remember being there with you and Jane recording something.
Similar situation, as I recall.
And she, not only, I mean, she's one of those people who...
She's very affectionate.
She's very affectionate.
Let's put it
but
that
she's
way.
Really delightful and a total pro.
Oh, you know what it was? Pro. It was the look of love, I think.
Oh, Burt Bacharach. Yeah, that might have been where it was.
And she just insisted that I come in the studio and be with her.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the sexiest look of love you will ever hear in your life.
So why don't, what do you want? Should we play something from Sondheim at the movies?
Yeah, sure. Play, you know, I love, play Sand, because I have an interesting story about Sand.
Okay, well, let's hear it, and then you can tell your story.
Yeah.
Love is just sand, slippery but clinging. Love is just sand, stir it and it flies. Love is just grand, till you feel it stinging your eyes. Love is just sand, slipping through your fingers. Now it's in hand, now it isn't there. Just like sand, even when it lingers, all it's about is you can't get it out of your hair. It can seem smooth when really it's bumpy. It can look soft and be dry. Warm and be soothing, hot and make you jumpy, although you'll never know. Sahara or a beach beneath a Caribbean sky. Love is just sand, you can feel it shifting. Soon as you stand, you begin to sink. Everything's planned, then it gets to drifting, never to where you think. Love ain't solid.
That was Christiane Noll, by the way, singing Sand. And Bruce has a
story. Not only singing Sand. So we're in the studio, and we record the band first. And Christiane's there to do a scratch vocal, and we're, you know, loving his orchestration, Larry's orchestration, Larry Moore. And we get to the instrumental, and I had just had this same problem on What Can You Lose? And in both songs, he had a sax solo, instrumental, mm-hmm. in the middle. And I said, I don't, what is that? I don't, that's so not what these songs are. So Larry, in true Larry fashion, said, well, what do you want? I don't get it. I said, anything but that. So for the What Can You Lose, I said, why don't we have Kevin Kuhn here, the beautiful, the best guitarist in New York. Let him do a guitar solo and let's put him on the whole song, mm-hmm. doing that beautiful vamp. Oh, fine, if you want to try it. So it made the song, needless mm-hmm. to say. Mm-hmm. It totally made that track magical. It's what all I'm ever looking for is the magic. So with Christiane's song, Sand, we get to that instrumental. I hear the sax. I said, Larry, no, I can't. He said, well, what do you hear? You don't hear a guitar, do you? I said, no. I said, if you really want to know what I hear a theremin. You know,
right at first.
And he said, oh, well, we can't have a theremin. Where are you going to get that? Who plays the theremin? I don't play a theremin. I don't even know where you get that. And he's going on and on. Christiane raising her hand. And she says, I can be a theremin. I said, go in. And she, that's what you hear on the album. Ooh. And she's brilliant.
I don't think I'd ever heard that story.
Yeah.
That's too funny.
Yes. I'm a theremin.
That's so funny.
That's why we love Christiane.
And I have to tell people, this is a little bit of a tangent, but having sat in on quite a few, several of your recording sessions, whether it was, because I know I was there for a lot of the Christiane Noel Ira Gershwin album. Right. I was there for the Emily Skinner album. There were a couple others that I was spent a lot of time in the studio with the recording sessions. And I have to tell people, Bruce has the most amazing ear. You do. Because I remember being back in the booth listening to some of the playbacks with you, and you would be able to spot like the smallest little thing that no one else could hear. And you would say, no, right there. And you'd make him go back and you say, no, that we need to fix this. This doesn't sound. And it was just the tiniest little thing.
Yeah, I'm a little...
Or you would do something like you just said, where they would be playing and you'd be like, no, I don't think we need that particular instrument in this at all. I mean, just cut that. Let's just try it without that person playing. And you would be right. And that's one of the things that made you such a great producer. It makes you such a great producer is because you do have the right ear for this.
I'm either blessed or cursed with my ears. Because I do. I hear everything. And I want to hear everybody in the orchestration. Right. A lot of things I get are just blends. Mm-hmm. And I miss inner lines, or the band is too recessed or anything. Right. And I want the band to be a character with the singer, you know, to dance around the singer, always the singer in front of the band.
Right.
But yeah, I hear it all. I'm terrible. And the thing is, when we would do a band session and we wouldn't catch a clam somewhere, let's say, and so we had to live with the clam. Mm-hmm. What I became really adept at, and I'm probably giving away a trade secret here, but I really am good at this. In magic, if you're at the Magic Castle, they achieve the magic by distracting the eye.
Yeah, of course.
I achieve hiding clams by distracting the ear. So I either, at the time, exact moment the clam happens, I have the engineer raise something else up. And it literally distracts you from hearing the clam. You do not hear, it's there, but you can't hear it because the oboe came up. Oh,
right.
You know, and it covers it and doesn't cover it completely. It's there. Mm-hmm. Or I boost the singer or I do something to distract your ears from hearing the clam. And there are clams.
Yes. let's talk about one more Sondheim album, particularly called the Sondheim album. Shall we talk about that one?
Yeah.
Because that one is like a spectacular album. I think this is one of everybody's favorite
albums.
This
was the first album for Finsworth Alley. I began Finsworth Alley with a Sondheim and a Liz Calloway.
I know. Well, I remember when you were starting Finsworth Alley, you even told me, you said, my first project is going to be a Stephen Sondheim album.
Yeah.
It's just, it's sort of like, it's a good talisman for you. You've got to start with a Sondheim album.
And he's...
And this is like on the top of everybody's list of the albums that you've produced.
And he was very happy, again, you know, for him, you know, the more the merrier.
Right.
But this one was, we didn't really have rarities, except for the bonus track, if you bought it at Finsworth Alley.
Yes,
we had one of his teenage songs that Emily Skinner did.
Yes, which is a gorgeous song.
Yeah, I'll take you. I Must Be Dreaming.
I Must Be Dreaming.
Yeah. And, but choosing the songs was great fun for me because I chose them by the people I wanted to sing them.
Right. And so, it's an amazing lineup.
Yeah. So for we were the only other recording and probably still are the only other recording of Make the Most of Your Music because it's such a complicated song.
And that's a great way to open the album.
Yeah. And so that's Brent. That's and that orchestration, which I think is David Siegel. Right? I think Lanny may have done a couple.
I don't know.
For this.
It says orchestrations are David Siegel.
Yeah. Yes. I think Lanny may have done a chart or two. But
The lineup, just so people know the lineup, if they have not heard this album.
Yeah.
It's Brent Barrett, Jane Krakowski, Liz Calloway, Alice Ripley, Leah Delaria, Brian Darcy James, Ruthie Henshall, Dorothy Loudon. I mean, it's an amazing with Norm Lewis. And of course, Dame Edna. Which we have to talk a little bit about Dame Edna.
Yeah, she just passed away.
Barry Humphries just passed away, which is very sad. But
well, that's a funny story, too.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that, because that's like one of the most controversial tracks
on this album. It is the most controversial
because
track I've ever done.
It is, because people were so outraged.
Some
people were,
yeah.
But they were so outraged. And what I loved about reading some of the outrageous comments online, which still pop up occasionally, is that, oh, Sondheim must have been furious that he let Dame Edna sing Losing My Mind and she desecrated the song. And, oh my God, I can't imagine how Stephen Sondheim let Bruce Kimmel get away with this. Tell your story.
So I go to the, I guess it was the Booth Theater.
Oh, right.
To see Dame Edna perform in New York. This was in 2000.
Oh, God, I don't know.
One.
I mean.
2001.
She did lots of shows.
No, 2000.
She did several Broadway.
No, this was in 2000, in the summer of 2000. I was just planning this album. Maybe even before summer. And I went and saw it. I snagged a ticket. Great ticket to it. I didn't know Dame Edna from a hole in the wall, but it sounded like fun. And somebody had said, you have to go see Dame Edna. So I got this, I think it was a house seat from somebody. I have never laughed so hard in my life. And thank God.
I saw that production too, because I remember seeing her at the booth.
I was so, and grateful that I wasn't, she didn't bring
pull
me
you
up.
The audience.
Because I hate that. But she was, it was so, I was weeping. You know, you couldn't catch your breath. And a lot of that stuff is off the cuff.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. That was the brilliance of Barry Humphries, was that not only was he able to, he was able to ad-lib this stuff in character, and it all made sense.
Oh, yeah.
And it was hysterically funny.
Well, all that stuff with whoever he brought up was all, you know, making the calls.
Right.
And so I wrote a note and sent it backstage and said, I'm doing this album, the Stephen Sondheim album. Boy, would I love Dame Edna to come sing Losing My Mind. I said, it just came to me right now. Would you do it? Here's my phone number. And they called me and they said, love to. That's a great idea. So I then had to call Steve.
Right. Well, because you're taking one of his most famous songs and you're doing something to it that I don't think that most people would expect.
Right. So I said to Steve, I said, you know, I had this idea and I think it's kind of clever. What would you think if Dame Edna sang Losing My Mind? He says, oh my God, that's perfect. He said, there's enough recordings of that song to last me a lifetime. And you have Dorothy Collins, who nobody is ever going to be better than Dorothy Collins. And so he was all for it. And when these people, it was mostly in the Sondheim Review, as I recall, came out of the woodwork and were just like, I was the devil, and how dare they, and this is the most horrifying thing I've ever heard, and what is the point, and how, and you know, and I wouldn't respond to any of it, you know, I just put it out. This is, it's not funny, and it's not that funny. And then I wrote Steve, and I said, have you seen these comments? He says, yes, these are, people are humorless.
Right.
He said, they have no sense of humor, and he ultimately wrote to the Sondheim Review and said, I thought it was funny.
Well, they all felt like they had to come to Sondheim's defense.
Yeah,
and be protective of him. Yeah. Not, of course. And of course, if they had really thought about it and knowing you, they would have should have known that you ran it by Sondheim first.
He loved it. He thought it was so hilarious.
How much of it, I mean, when you went into the recording studio with Dame Edna, first off, I'm assuming Barry Humphries was not in Dame Edna drag when he recorded it.
No, he was there to support
Dame Edna. Barry was there to support Dame Edna. But was it mostly, how much direction did you give her? Or did you just let her go for it?
Here's what I always do with everyone.
Right.
I don't give any direction.
Right.
And I let them go in and do a rehearsal, which I record.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the rehearsal was hilarious. Mm-hmm. He did his dialogue in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. And that was hilarious. And so I said, oh, that's great. Let's do one. Let's do take one. Mm-hmm. But I had that. You know, it wasn't perfect because he was fumfering with the lyrics and everything. So, but the funniest thing he did in that take was, it's like I'm losing. And I was on the floor when I heard that. Mm-hmm. Every losing was losing. And he didn't do it in take one.
Oh.
And I went back. I went right in the booth. I said, Dame Edna, I have to have you. He said, oh, you like that? I said, I have to have it. I said, it's a wonderful take, but I need losing. He says, take two. And take two is what you hear. But I think the dialogue came from the first.
The rehearsal.
The rehearsal. Because he was just so off the cuff with it in that take. So we did four takes. I have them all. And they're all equally funny. But I think take two was so beautiful.
And then Sondheim eventually heard this.
Yes, and he loved it. He just thought it was hilarious. And it is hilarious.
It is hilarious.
But, you know, in an odd way, it's not desecrating. It's just Dame Edna's
version of it.
Take.
Right. It's her interpretation of the song.
Yeah.
Which is what every singer does.
Yeah. And it's a viable interpretation.
Right. Right.
Of the actual
song. She's singing the lyrics.
Yeah.
As written.
But it was fun. I tell you, that was a day.
The sun comes up. I think about you. The coffee cup. I think about you. I want you so. It's like I'm losing my mind. The morning ends. I think about you. I talk to friends. I think about you. And do they know? It's like I'm losing my mind. All afternoon doing every little chore, the thought of you stays bright. Sometimes I stand in the middle of the floor, not going left, not going right. I dim the lights and think about you. Spend sleepless nights to think about you. You said you loved me, possum. Or were you just being kind? Or am I mind? Oh, Norm, Norm, darling, I miss you. It seems only yesterday that you had your first urological incident, and now I'm alone. Well, not exactly alone, with millions of adoring admirers clamoring at my stage door. But still, darling Norm Possum, there'll always be a little nook in my heart where you will belong. Does no one know? It's like I'm losing my mind. All afternoon doing everything. shore. The thought of you stays bright. Sometimes I stand in the middle of the floor, not going left, not going right. I dim the lights and think about you, spend sleepless nights to think about you. You said you loved me. Or were you just being kind? Or am I losing my mind?
That was a whole separate session for just him, because he came after a Sunday matinee, as I recall.
So you also did a whole series of, we don't necessarily have to, you have done a cast recording, by the way.
Yeah, Merrily.
You did Merrily We Roll Along from the York Theater.
The York, but we did, unlike the York that had three instruments.
Right.
We used Jonathan Tunick's smaller orchestration that he had done for La Jolla, which I think was 12 pieces. Right. And that was fun. That was great fun. And that was it was intense because there was so much music. Mm-hmm. To record that we started on an evening and got things done. It took forever to do the overture. Mm-hmm. Because it took a long time for the engineer, Vinny, to get the blends right so that Tunick was happy, because Tunick was there and Sondheim was there. So we did a very tough three-hour night the first night. And then we did two sessions the following day, and those went beautifully, and he was up totally fine with me giving direction, because I didn't want the director there,
right?
Because I did not like some of the interpretations of the songs, and I don't think he did either. So I let her come because she called me and she said, "Please, I won't say anything." I said, "It's fine, Susan Schulman, very nice lady, but not." Recording is different than being on stage.
So totally different.
For Ann Bobby, I went in and gave her some help on Not a Day Goes By, and just to make it work for the ear rather than seeing her, because I love Ann Bobby.
I had forgotten the cast in this show. It was a great cast.
Yeah, Malcolm Getz and Adam Heller.
Danny Burstein and Adrian Lennox.
Michelle Pauk.
I mean, it's Cass Morgan. I'm looking at these names going, I know like most of these people. It's a great cast.
It is.
It's one of the, and they're,
There are people who like this as much as the other,
other ones. So you also did a bunch of Terry Trotter.
Sondheim in jazz. I was determined to bring jazz covers of Broadway back.
Right.
And I did.
You did. Well, you did.
Nobody had done one of those, I think, in 30 years.
Right. And you did a whole series of them, but you really had a little bit of special focus on Sondheim musicals.
Oh, mostly.
Yeah, because there were some other ones you did.
Yeah.
Like Fantastics and Chicago
and Cabaret.
And Cabaret. But this one, you covered, the ones I have anyway. You've got Sweeney Todd. You've got Passion. I've got Little Night Music, Forum, Follies, and Company.
Yeah, those are it.
That's it. I think
that's six or so.
Yeah. And so, the idea obviously was to go back to the old days when they used to do jazz show tune.
Yeah, because I grew up loving those. I loved those sometimes more than the albums. Mm-hmm. And I had them all. I bought them all. I had three or four different gypsy and jazzes, which I loved. And I can't even remember now. But Cy Coleman used to do.
Right.
He did The King and I in jazz.
Right.
And Flower Drum Song in jazz, he did. And I had a Flower Drum Song with Morris Nanton's trio on Warner Brothers Records, because I loved Warner Brothers Records.
Was Sondheim involved at all with any of these?
No.
But he knew you were doing them.
He knew I was doing them. Mm-hmm. He did not understand. After he got Passion, he said, we talked, and he said, "I don't really get it. Why do they not play the melody all the time?" I said, because that's jazz. I said, but here's how to understand it.
Right.
Because he really didn't get it.
Right.
He said, I don't understand when they're just not playing the tune. Mm-hmm. I said, here's the thing about jazz. They play the tune, establish the tune, and then they improvise around the tune. Mm-hmm. I said, but the harmony never changes. You can sing the song mm-hmm. while they're improvising, and the chords are all
right.
The harmonics.
Right.
Once he understood that, he loved all of them. He loved Terry. Uh-huh. He wrote Terry the sweetest note. And he said, do more, do more, do more. And when I sent him a little night music, which is Terry, I had the notion Terry should do that solo. Mm-hmm. And he said, where's the trio? But he loved them. And, you know, Passion was the first one. And sometimes you go into a studio, and I don't remember even the studio we did that in, NRG maybe, and studio I hadn't been in before. And it was just, or maybe it was Westlake. It may have been Westlake. So we go in there, and it's just one of these things. Terry, you know, I direct people. So we're in the studio, and we're doing Passion, and I see no difference in working with musicians than I do with singers.
Right.
And that freaks out musical directors sometimes. But I'll go in and go, no, you know, can you give it this kind of feel? Or I'll say to the drummer, can you try something else? Or, and they just have to trust me that I know what I'm hearing and want to hear. So if it, like there's a trumpet solo and it feels like it should be like a Jackie Gleason easy, you know, one of those midnight music Jackie Gleason solo, I would say Bobby Hackett, do Bobby Hackett it. And the trumpet players all knew what that meant.
Right.
And you got that. So for Passion and Jazz, so I would go in and they would do a take and I would go in and talk to Terry only. And I'd go, you know, maybe it was good, but let's maybe try this feeling, you know, as if. And I would give an image or something, and jazz musicians really respond to that kind of thing because it's all feeling.
Right.
And so that was – but that album, Passion, which we did prior to the show opening. Mm-hmm. So we were out before the cast album. Right. They played Passion and Jazz at the cast party.
Oh, really?
The opening night party.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. But everything – sound-wise, perfect. Mm-hmm. I've never had that happen with any other Terry Trotter album or any album where I haven't had to work to get it right. This was like the most beautiful sounding. And if you hear that, it's perfect. Just the sound of the piano and the where the bass sits and where the drums are. And we had the best, you know, in that trio. It was Bill Evans' final drummer, Joe LaBarbera, who is just a poet. You don't think about poetry and drums, but his brushwork is like nothing you've ever heard. And I don't think people get that that can actually be a thing.
Right, yeah.
Thank you.
let's move on from Sondheim.
Yeah, let's.
And let's talk about your newest book, because people have to remember that you are also an author, and this is what, book number 23?
Yes, 23.
And it is called Preview Harvey.
Preview Harvey. Nobody knows what that means, so I'll tell you. But
well, yes, what was the inspiration, and give us a kind of a synopsis?
I've been wanting to write this book. I had the idea to write this book a long time ago, probably 15 or 16 years ago, 17 years ago, right after the Kritzer. Mm-hmm. Things. And I had a little, I started writing it. And so I had like a paragraph. And I didn't like the paragraph much. Just didn't feel right to me, you know, but I liked the idea of it. And the idea of it was inspired by a real guy who was called Preview Henry, who I would run into because I was a preview nut. I had to go to all the previews in the days when nobody knew what the preview was.
Yes. I remember those. They were still going on when I was going to movies.
You saw in the paper, it would say,
see, there's a special
major
preview,
studio preview.
And sometimes they would give you like a hint, see, but the director's name.
That was later. That was the 80s.
Right.
Late 70s to 80s, it all changed. But in the 50s, when I started going, and the 60s and most of the 70s, all you would see is major studio preview or sneak preview or important press preview, or, you know, there were various names they call them. Nobody knew. They were the closest guarded secrets, the closest it ever came to knowing in advance, at least who was in it, was when I saw A Visit to a Small Planet, because they had Jerry Lewis's caricature. Major studio preview tonight, and his character. I said, oh, well, that's got to be a Jerry Lewis picture. And it was Visit to a Small Planet. So, but Preview Henry, the real guy, was a short guy, and nobody knew anything about his past or history or anything about him, really. And I would see him at every preview. I went to every preview. There was no preview I attended where Preview Henry wasn't there. Even when there were multiple previews, we all had the same idea, go to the biggest theater.
Right.
So I was frequently at the Village or the Chinese or the Pickwood, you know, those big, big theater, the Wilshire. And those days were so interesting to me in the movies I saw. And in the 70s, he was like adopted by the studios. The studios loved him and they got him into the previews for free. Starting the later 60s. So he was their good luck charm. And I thought, this is a book. This is a character study.
Right.
I love this. And I'd only met him, talked to him, and not even talked to him, but when Nudie Musical had its very first preview, which was the work print and a separate track at the Academy Theater in Pasadena in 1975, September, I have the theater listing, sneak preview tonight with Tommy. Packed theater, but I had my friend who booked that worked for Mann Theaters, so he booked that preview for us. And so he was there, but I said, can you get Preview Henry there? Because that would mean so, that would mean we've arrived to me. He said, yeah, I'll do that, because I guess he knew how to contact him, and he did, and Preview Henry was there, and Preview Henry came up to me afterwards and said, I didn't know you were in a movie, and I didn't know you made a movie. This is great. This was funny and hilarious. I thought, we made it.
You made it.
We made it.
It had Preview Henry's stamp of approval.
Yeah, so when I started writing it, I just couldn't get away into it. It didn't feel right to me. I was writing in the third person.
Well, because it can't just be a diary of every preview he goes to.
Well, that's,
I mean, you got to create some sort of,
that's
some
what
sort of
I,
background.
Yes, for that's what I finally came in December when I was really struggling to think of an idea for a book. I had an idea for a thriller that I didn't feel like writing because it was negative. So I went back to this idea, and I called my muse, Margaret, and I said, I have this old idea. What do you think about this? And I explained to her what it was. I said, because I think I found a way into it. And she loved it. Mm-hmm. She said, you got to write that right now. And the way in was having a fictional author mm-hmm. of the book you're reading.
Yes.
Preview Harvey. The book would start with him mm-hmm. saying he was my uncle, or, you know, it was the niece of somebody, a nephew of somebody mm-hmm. down the chain.
Right.
And he's given this box of cassettes, uh-huh. audio cassettes, of Harvey talking about his life and his previews. Mm-hmm. And he makes these tapes in 1968. Uh-huh. So it covers from his first preview in 1954 all the way to 1968. Mm-hmm. And then there's one, he finds one, after he's written the foreword and the afterword, he finds one more tape, mm-hmm. which brings him current to the early 80s. Mm-hmm. But it's very sporadic. He stops and starts. Whereas the first tape from 68, all those tapes are consecutive tapes he makes. He mm-hmm. stops, you know, he'll shut it off, have dinner.
Right.
So I created a family for him, a mother and father, and apartments and where they lived and his history. And as you will read, he has a condition, mm-hmm. which I don't name, because there was no name for it in those days. Mm-hmm. Not even in the 60s, I don't think there was a name for it. I don't know when they came up for the stuff on the spectrum, but mm-hmm. So it's very, he repeats everything a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, he can't say it once. He has to say it three times, you know. Uh-huh. I mean. So that was really fun to write because it's stream of consciousness of these tapes, you know.
Which a lot of things like that
are. Yeah, I mean, he buys one of the first cassette recorders mm-hmm. and only 60-minute tapes mm-hmm. back then. And so he talks about his childhood and his sister who died when she was four. Mm-hmm. And it's very moving mm-hmm. in ways. And then he talks about his first time he was taken to a movie to see Hold That Blonde mm-hmm. when he was very young. And, 'cause he's born in 1940. And in 1954, he's taken to a major studio preview at the Village Theater in CinemaScope and color, and he had never seen cinema, so he didn't know what that mm-hmm, meant. Mm-hmm. So he looked it up, and it said, more than your eyes have ever seen. Mm-hmm. You see it without glasses. And he said, well, I don't wear glasses anyway. So so he sees a preview of The High and the Mighty, which mm-hmm. I swear I saw mm-hmm. at the Village Theater, but it never played the Village. So I think I saw a preview of it.
Ah.
Because it played the Pickwood, which is in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But I vividly remember the Village. Mm-hmm. And my memory is pretty...
Your memory is pretty good.
Pretty good. Yeah. So I think I saw a preview of it. So he sees a preview of that. Changes his life. It's a life changer.
Right.
Then he just wants to go to every preview.
Right.
And that's the book. He talks about every movie, not every movie, because there's some stinkers he won't talk about.
Right.
But every movie that meant something to him. But in between the movies, you get his family life, where he worked at Wallach's Music City.
Ah, Wallach's Music City.
And, you know, where he what he likes to eat. And there's a lot of family stuff, which is really fun. I just created a really loving, good, interesting family for him. And but mostly it's movie. It's a list book, mm-hmm. and but the way he talks about the movies is what's unique,
right?
And in the course of the book, not that this ever happened to me or him, I don't think, the real guy, but I have him meet Blake Edwards, who becomes a thing with mm-hmm, him. Mm-hmm. Jerry Lewis he meets, and Jerry Lewis gives him the name Preview Harvey. Uh-huh. And then he meets other people too, and a lot of studio people. And he meets Robert Evans, and and he's influential in a way. He gives his opinions,
right?
And so it was really. I just had a ball writing it. It never got old to me. Mm-hmm. I think there was one time my muse was just never had any notes or any comments. One time she thought I did too many movies in one section. So I just cut three of them out. You know, just cut out four pages. Then it was fine. But
and so the book is now
available. It's at the publisher, and it's supposed to. I'm supposed to see a galley. I thought I was going to see it last week, and I haven't seen it yet. Hopefully tomorrow or the next day.
And are you taking pre-orders?
Yeah, pre-orders are up on the Kritzerland site.
Okay, we'll include a link so people can, can check it out.
And it's really fun. I got great blurbs for it from John Landis, who directed The Blues Brothers and American and Werewolf.
Well, it's really about, because it's something that's near and dear to you, because I know that this is part of your past history also, which which is Los Angeles and the movies.
Yeah.
And movie going.
And a total preview nut.
Right.
And all these glorious theaters that aren't with us anymore. And it's fascinating. I just think it's really interesting, and what he likes and what he doesn't like, what he responds to, and it was fun, you know, sort of fantasizing, gee, if I had met Blake Edwards, you know. But, you know, he doesn't obviously want to make movies, preview Harvey. Right. But
he just loves movies.
But loves them. And it's also what's really fun in the book is to watch his tastes grow and change. Because in the early 60s, he starts loving black and white foreign movies. So he loves Sundays and Sabelle, and he loves The Trial, and he loves, you know, what That Man from Rio. So those become his favorites. And the low-budget stuff like David and Lisa or The Miracle Worker, he likes those better than the big-budget movies.
Right.
So it was really – but there's a lot of stuff I don't talk about. Like, I don't ever, maybe once – talk about a movie he's seen that wasn't a sneak preview. So I mention – that his parents buy him a reserved seat for West Side Story, but I never talk about his reaction to it because it wasn't a preview.
Wasn't a preview. Interesting.
So, and at the end of the book, there's an addendum where I list every movie mentioned in the book, and the author, the fictional author, says, I've put an addendum in the book. Check these movies out, even the stinkers. They're all interesting.
That's very. It's very clever.
Cool. So it was fun.
And what else is new at, with Kritzerland?
Just we're doing our cabarets, you know. We do,
well, you do your cabaret
shows, and we're
heading
to 13 years.
Oh Lord!
Oh my God! We just did our 124th show,
and you are at the Gardenia.
We're back at where we began at the Gardenia because Vitello's is no more, and the Federal is too weird for me.
Right.
Yeah, I mean there are some cabaret shows that are playing there too, but I don't know who's booking them because it's not the booker. Because I talk to the booker.
Right.
And the booker says, I don't know what you're talking about. And those shows are not on their calendar. So I don't know who they're booking through, but I don't want any part of it.
Right.
So, you know, I like the Gardenia. You know, it's, it used to be the only club in Los Angeles.
I know. It's like
everybody
the
played
oldest,
there.
It's the oldest, longest
it's
running
It's a difficult
club.
Room to play, and you can't have more than 56 people in there.
Right. It's a tricky room. I've seen several shows there.
But we have fun, and I know how to play the room, and we just did one, and it was great. And
we have some new
we have more albums coming out. There's a, I think we're waiting on Vernon Duke 3 to show up.
Is that one of the last of the Ben Bagley?
I think that is the last
of
the
Ben
Bagley. People keep saying to me, no, there's a Jerome Kern this and a thing that. I said, we've done those tracks. Are on. Either Ben put them on or I put them on.
Right.
Because I did put all the Jerome Kern tracks that weren't on.
And those, I got to tell you, I've met so many people who have said to me, I'm so glad Bruce is releasing these Ben Bagley albums and cleaning them up.
Well, they never would have sound been better. Available otherwise.
Right.
So,
because people love them.
Yeah. So there were like, there's like 43 of them.
My God.
We haven't sold out of any. So a couple are close now, but if people want them, they better buy them because I'm not doing them again.
Right. And they're great. I mean, people, if you've never seen, never heard the Ben Bagley albums, you need to go.
Because
they're almost, they're sort of like Lost in Boston, unsung musicals.
Predecessors. That's right.
Yours.
Smaller bands.
But fantastic lineup of artists.
Amazing artists. Anthony Perkins and Tammy Grimes. Catherine Hepburn. I mean, what else do you want?
I mean, how he got these people in the studio, I'll never know. But they're
certainly
fascinating to listen to.
He didn't pay them.
And somebody, I will not say who, because I don't, but somebody went online at a sharing site that I know of that I oftentimes frequent because I'm oftentimes looking for out of print stuff or hard to find stuff. But they did, which I, of course, I downloaded, even though I have all of it. They pulled all of the Dolores Gray tracks and basically made an Dolores album. Gray sure. Does Ben Bagley album of all of the Dolores
Gray and tracks, I may end up which doing is fantastic. That. I may end up doing, you know, I'm going to do a Tammy Grimes.
You could.
So not from the Ben Bagley's, but I have a Tammy Grimes album.
Oh, okay.
But I may put some bonus tracks from the Bagley's on.
Because I know there are people who just have to manually do that. They take all their Ben Bagley ones and they pull all the tracks by certain artists and create a playlist.
We may go to that land at some point.
Because I saw it and I went, oh, I got to download this. Yeah. Even though I know I have all the CDs. I was like, oh, this is great. Now I have a digital copy.
You know, we may go there. And but I have this, I've been sitting on this Tammy Grimes album that I want to do that was on an Offbeat label. Mm-hmm. It's called Offbeat. And I have more Julius Monk that I'll get around to. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to start doing a new thing with the next release, which is foreign cast albums.
Oh, love those.
Of foreign shows.
Oh, that's great.
So I'm starting with my favorite of them.
Okay.
I'm not going to say what it is.
You can tell me off mic.
Yes.
You can tell me off mic.
But
because I love, that's the other thing that's actually becoming more popular now is people like to track down the foreign cast recordings.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, I'm listening to them more than I used to.
Yeah.
And just last year, I don't know if you've heard them or not. You probably have. But you know, because on my year-end top 10 that I do every year of cast recordings and vocalist recordings, two of them were the Spanish cast recordings that came out last year with Antonio Banderas's.
Oh, yeah. Those were good albums.
The Company one and the Chorus Line one. Wonderful albums.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just fantastic. And I love that they're getting more exposure.
Yeah. Well, I grew up, again, I would buy them when I was a kid. But
doing some foreign musicals that are great.
Well, that's the thing. They're good.
Yeah.
Some of this stuff. And the one we're doing is a delightful score. It's in a different language, of course, but who cares? It's based on an English play.
Cool.
And and I loved it when I was young. So I figured, why not do this?
That's cool. Very fun.
So we got, so there'll be a series of those. We just did the London How to Succeed.
Right. I don't think I should have asked you for a copy of that. I don't think I got a copy of that.
Yeah, we have.
I would love that.
And, you know, whatever I can get, this Stage Door record seems to glom on to a lot of this stuff before I can even.
Oh, I know. Stage Door has been doing a lot of stuff. Yeah, I've noticed that.
They get to stuff before I get to it, or, you know. It's fine.
It's a competitive. I am just thrilled that there are so many labels that are interested in this stuff.
Yeah.
Because they're like reviving these old recordings and putting them out again. And it's just nice because, and believe me, I think there's an audience out there for this.
There is. I mean, Stage Door has it easy because they can do the American stuff pre-64 for free.
Right. Exactly.
Now they have been licensing stuff post 64, but they get all of that. But I could do the same for the British shows, but they've been doing them all.
Right. They've been jumping on the British.
Can't get to them. It's really irritating. So we'll see where we go from here.
Well, we're going to close out because we've been talking for quite a while.
Yes.
But let's play one more Sondheim song.
Okay. What do you want?
What do you think is your favorite Sondheim track that you've recorded? Just because maybe it's a song that you've always wanted to do.
Won't choose that, but I will choose the perfect ender.
Oh, okay.
Goodbye for Now with Liz Calloway from Unsung Sondheim.
Okay. Well, thank you, Bruce, for coming.
My pleasure.
It was great. Everybody, make sure you check the Kretzerland website out. There will be a link. Go see Amazon and see Sammy.
Watch Sammy. Leave a review.
Help get the word out so people will check out this delightful
show. Yeah, we want this to be a hit so we can do season 2.
It's fun. It's very, I had a great time watching it. And I will, and you probably will binge it. I binged the whole thing because I didn't want to stop.
For the
pie
fight.
I was like, okay, keep going.
For the pie fight alone.
Right.
And Sammy was a trooper.
Well, and the nice thing that I also like is it's also a wonderful showcase for Sammy Stateman. And she does. I always forget what a fantastic singer she is. She's a wonderful singer.
Unique. Nobody has a voice like hers.
She's just a wonderful singer. And I think some of my favorite moments were just the moments where she's in the recording studios doing
The ballads,
the demo tracks, the ballads. And you just, and you get to really see her sing, and the camera work is perfect, and it's just a fantastic.
I had a great cameraman.
It's just fantastic. So anyway, I encourage you all to go watch Sammy and buy the book, pre-order the book, which is Preview Harvey. You can find the link. I'll send a link. I'll put a link for Chris Erland for Preview Harvey on there also.
Links, hot links.
Lots of links. Anyway, thank you again, Bruce. And we are going to hear Liz Callaway singing, what is it?
Goodbye for Now from Reds, from the movie Reds.
Yes, I know. Goodbye.